Hey, welcome to Politico Tech. Today's Friday, June 28th. I'm Stephen Overly. The last decade has given rise to a new political actor, the social media influencer. These are often regular people who amass more followers than celebrities or politicians, can broadcast to larger audiences than the news media, and in some cases, garner more trust than all of the above. Renee DiResta captured this new class of power players in her book, Invisible Rulers: The People Who Turned Lies into Reality. She writes that some influencers use their power earnestly to advocate for political causes, and for others, it's simply a money grab, one that has them willing to peddle disinformation and rage in exchange for views. Now, Renee knows all about liars on the internet. For years, she has documented and researched disinformation campaigns, from anti-vaxxers to election deniers. Most recently, she was the technical research manager at the Stanford Internet Observatory. Now, the Stanford Internet Observatory became well known for investigating election misinformation after the 2016 race, but its work on the 2020 election drew the ire of conservatives after Donald Trump's loss. Renee and her colleagues not only became the subject of a congressional investigation, but were targeted with harassment, both online and in the real world. And as we head into the 2024 race, all of this has had a chilling effect on the world of disinformation research. Recently, Renee's contract at the Stanford Internet Observatory was ended, and that group is being dismantled as Stanford pivots its research away from election-related disinformation. It's a decision that Republican Representative Jim Jordan hailed as a win for free speech. On the show today, Renee tells me more about these invisible rulers shaping our politics and the struggle to keep their lies in check. Renee, welcome to Politico Tech.
Thanks for having me.
Who are these invisible rulers and how have they become so influential?
Yeah, so invisible rulers, the title of the book comes from a phrase by Edward Bernays, the sort of father of modern PR and a propagandist himself during World War I. And he uses them to describe the people behind the politicians that you see, the people who are thinking up creative advertising campaigns, who are creating demand for products, demand for political positions, demand for ideologies. And he says they're invisible rulers who control the destinies of millions. And these are the people who actually shape public opinion. So I wanted to write about the evolution now a century later, as I do a lot of work studying modern propaganda. You know, I was for about 5 years the technical research manager at Stanford Internet Observatory. And in my studies of propaganda, both from state actors, domestic ideologues, you name it, I wanted to write about the role that influencers played now, which was very, very akin to this idea of invisible rulers that Bernays had advanced a century ago.
What kind of power do those influencers have now in terms of shaping our politics?
So you start to see some political campaigns, even President Barack Obama, realizing that going on an influential YouTuber's channel is a great way to reach younger audiences, right? Or extremely online audiences. So you start to see it kind of enter the political realm really through appearances at first. And then you start to see campaigns begin to use influencers to help push messages out. So the Trump campaign in 2016, I think it's Professor Shannon McGregor has written about this, does a lot of work to incorporate influencers into like DM groups and things so that when they want to get a message out, they can reach out to these folks who are already ideologically aligned and just say, hey, can you help boost this, right? So you start to see the influencer as boost. In 2020, I think it is, you see during the primaries, Michael Bloomberg actually kind of hires some Instagram influencers to produce content for him. And this isn't a secret. They're pretty transparent about it. But it's when people begin to realize that you can actually use them for political advertising pretty explicitly as well. And the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, doesn't quite have particularly strong rules on what is acceptable there. So you start to see the influencer become a figure in politics. The other thing that starts to happen, though, is that they themselves begin to realize that they can produce content for niche audiences, highly, highly activist, factional niche audiences, and they can monetize it themselves. So being, for example, a right-wing influencer on X right now can be very, very lucrative because you can grow a very large audience. Your content is sort of boosted by the algorithm if you're producing content for a group that is very much there and is very much there for a political fight. What you start to see is people who then can also directly monetize it through views and engagement with their content on the platform. So it really becomes financially advantageous for the influencer also to create content for a niche. And so that's where it really moves. You know, ideology becomes a big part of what you can earn a living on as an influencer, and you start to see those figures begin to grow more popular over the last few years.
I feel like we've also seen examples of it kind of working the other direction, where ideas and viewpoints will kind of come up through the influencer crowd, will gain traction on social media, and then will enter politics, right? Will then become talking points that we hear from elected officials. How has that dynamic itself also changed our politics?
So for a long time in many prior media ecosystems, you had much more of a push dynamic, right? A television personality would push a message out, you know, would sit on the, you know, on screen and deliver the news, for example, or deliver commentary. Newspapers, again, same thing. Somebody prominent would write commentary. Radio, same thing. But with social media, you're having a conversation. The audience is speaking back to you. And very directly, in fact, if you're an influencer, right? The influencers really gain their power through this relationship they have with their audience. That's what the early advertisers realize, and that's what the politicians realize as well. And so that very participatory nature means it's not only the influencer, they're not media or celebrity the way that we have thought about those things in other environments, but they're playing a higher visibility role in a much more participatory conversation. So instead of people on the internet only talking about what happened on the nightly news or what they read in the paper or, you know, the way that media used to function, you have these moments, these sort of viral moments on the internet where internet culture shapes a trend, makes something go viral, creates a main character, and then media reports on that. So it becomes some people on the internet are saying becomes a very kind of common way of describing politics, describing political conversations. And then you do see the politicians realizing that this is where thousands to millions of people are talking about them or an idea or an ideology. They're giving it maybe a hashtag, they're creating a meme for it, and they want to be part of that conversation. They want to harness that energy. And so they're drawing off of that influencer crowd. And then the third piece is the algorithm, right, that adds visibility. So this influencer algorithm crowd model is what is shaping political discourse, and the politicians then can leverage that.
You know, I've talked to a number of folks now about this idea of living in kind of a post-fact world, the way in which disinformation has become so rampant, especially in politics. A question that I come back to a lot, though, is sort of, are these influencers the disease or the symptom? In the sense, like, are they kind of the cause of distrust and disinformation that we're experiencing, you know, in society? Or are they just exploiting something that was already there?
No. Well, first, I want to caveat that there are a lot of really, really, really excellent influencers. So the book is not anti-influencer in any way, right? I spend a lot of time talking about just culture influencers who are, you know, they create representation for people who aren't used to seeing themselves maybe quite so prominently or maybe even in a news capacity. And so I talk about some of those folks. But the ones who are, you know, and I do spend quite a bit of time on what we might call the sort of most unethical, right? The ones who are like really explicitly there for profit and clout and facts be damned. That model works because they manage to amass a very high degree of trust with the crowd, right? The crowd sees them as a member of their own community. This is a guy who is just like me. This is a woman who is just like me. And so when they're saying something, the crowd feels like, you know, their voice is out there. Their voice is being heard. And that's one of the things that makes the influencer so powerful. Unfortunately, what you do see also then, though, is the phenomenon of audience capture, where this back and forth between the crowd and the influencer sometimes takes, you know, kind of a dark turn, right? The idea of going down a rabbit hole where the influencer may say something a little bit provocative, and then all of a sudden they find themselves in a feedback loop where the crowd really loves that. And so you start to see people becoming more extreme, being more willing to say things that aren't true. There's also very little in the way of accountability. So Whereas if a broadcast media outlet were to put, for example, let's use Dominion voting machines, right, were to say that Dominion voting machines had changed votes for Trump, you know, Dominion goes and sues Fox News and there's a massive multi-million dollar settlement on that.
Right.
The same narratives are all over the internet, right, and were all over the internet around the election in 2020. But there's very little accountability for influencers who do that sort of thing. And because, again, they're individuals, it's not seen necessarily as a particularly lucrative target for a defamation lawsuit. So it's just a very different model of trying to figure out, you know, what accountability looks like when they become willing to tell lies or willing to disinform their audiences.
You know, there was a line just in the introduction I thought was interesting where you said this is not really a book about social media per se, but the role of social media in sort of propping up these influencers and being kind of the home to some of these misinformation, disinformation campaigns we're talking about is certainly a recurring theme. I wonder how you see the role of social media and social media platforms in both creating kind of this dynamic we have now and then potentially addressing it as well.
So the influencer can't exist without social media, right? The influencer has that power to broadcast because of social media, and the influencer has that ability to monetize because of social media. So one of the things I wanted to do with the book, particularly where the idea of political propaganda was concerned, was do something akin to what Noam Chomsky had done with Manufacturing Consent, the book he wrote in the 1980s, which was to say, these are the incentives and the structures of the system, right? These are the incentives that lead media to produce the content that it does. And in the 80s, Chomsky is explaining advertisers, for example, right? Advertisers are going to pay newspapers for space, and the newspapers want to receive that advertising money. And so they're not necessarily going to criticize the companies that are doing the advertising, or they'll be less, you know, strident about it. And they're also producing content for the kinds of people the advertisers want to reach. So that also shapes coverage. So this idea that your outputs are shaped by the incentives of the system was something that was really kind of central to the book, right? Trying to explain to people we are where we are because these are the incentives we've created. In the same way Chomsky is not writing an anti-media book. He's writing a book to try to inform people about, you know, how to be informed consumers given these incentives. And that was kind of my goal as well, to try to explain the incentives that got us here.
One of the dynamics I pulled from the book, and you can tell me if this is what you had intended, was there's this dynamic where inciting rage and sort of appealing to people on a very visceral, emotional level is one way to command a lot of attention. And then once you have that attention, you can use it to make money, to gain influence, to get elected. Is that a core dynamic here? And how do you break that, if that's even the solution we should be looking for?
It is a core dynamic, yes. And I think it is one that we should be looking to break, because I don't think a politics built on rage is sustainable or healthy. And I think that
right.
I think that most people actually across the political spectrum would agree with me on that, that there are important debates to be had. This is not an argument that we're going to all hold hands and everybody's just going to get along all of a sudden. But where the platform incentive really comes into play is that desire to keep people engaged did lead them to default to pushing out content where once it got a little bit of engagement, they would boost it. And oftentimes the thing that got the little bit of engagement was rage bait. And now we're starting to see companies thinking about, are there ways to produce content using, you know, what's known as bridging, right? Trying to find ways to surface topics that are not necessarily like, here is why you should attack this other person, or, you know, I either support or oppose abortion, and here is why you should go attack my ideological enemies, but rather, here is my position, and here is how I'm trying to persuade you to think about this thing, right? So moving more towards what we might call more traditional sort of persuasive conversation that you would have in conversations between neighbors. And there are ways to surface content that does that. This is ironically one of the things that I think AI is actually potentially good at, which is recognizing.
Oh,
yeah, which is, I think, you know, Google Jigsaw has put out a little bit of work on this, bridging algorithms, they call them, where you can determine how things are framed when a person is expressing an opinion. And then the second order is, can you then use that understanding to surface types of content or to surface posts that are not quite so hostile, that are not quite so nasty?
There's this compulsion, I think, to want to assign blame, right? Blame the social media companies or blame politicians. You know, is blame easy to assign? And then what's the fix?
Well, I don't know that assigning blame is particularly productive at this point. It's, you know, here we are, right? What can we do differently? Right. So I spend some time in the book on design, which bridging algorithms, for example, is a form of design. Can you create a healthier system by shifting the incentives? Can you create a healthier system by rethinking what algorithms boost and make visible? There's a weird idea, particularly in groups on the right now, that the algorithm is somehow sacrosanct and that, you know, the way it is today is the way it has to be. But everything that you see is curated for you. Everything that you see is ranked in some way. And so you can do one of two things. One, on a centralized platform where there's largely going to only be one type of ranking, you can change what the weighting prioritizes. The other thing, though, is you can also give users more granular control. You're not really going to be able to do this very well on a centralized platform, but on platforms like Blue Sky, you are starting to see user-generated curation, ways that you can switch what you see by kind of like clicking a little button at the top of your, you know, phone or screen as you subscribe to a feed. And I think that that is also giving users a little bit more agency. But holding design aside, right, because it's not solely a technological problem, I do think that informing people about why this happens is very, very important, because we all do click the like button, the share button, you know, we all do serve as amplifiers, we all do serve as participants. So one of the goals of the book was actually to try to explain how little decisions that we make individually actually can have far bigger impact when you think about them in the aggregate, particularly when you think about what you're normalizing among your peer group, what you're normalizing among your political community.
You know, this work you're doing and have done for years around studying online behavior, in particular studying, you know, disinformation, who pushes it out and sort of how it gains traction, has come under a lot of political attack recently, as you well know, conservative politicians in particular, you know, launching investigations into disinformation researchers, especially those who were focused on Donald Trump's 2020 election loss. What impact has that had on your work?
Well, you know, up until recently, I was the technical research manager at Stanford Internet Observatory, and our group was one of the participants in the Election Integrity Partnership, which is one of the groups that I think received the first set of subpoenas from Jim Jordan as he, you know, went on this this sort of wild goose chase, thinking that there was some vast cabal and the work was some anti-right-wing censorship machine. I mean, nothing could be further from the truth. And we had, you know, we did our work very, very publicly in 2020. We constantly had tweet threads out there, blog posts, you know, constantly reporting on what we were seeing, which was basically tracking election rumors related to procedures and policies of voting, and then rumors that tried to preemptively delegitimize the election. And what a lot of these folks did was they held these, you know, ridiculous show hearings, really just designed to get a, you know, a Twitter clip as opposed to designed to do any sort of actual oversight. But the effect it had was that people who were mentioned or who were covered or who received letters or subpoenas or whose documents were turned over to Jordan, a lot of the material was then sort of leaked. It was misinterpreted. One sentence was pulled out of an email to prove a point that they already, you know, had decided was true, even if it wasn't. And that leads to a lot of online harassment. That leads to a lot of threats. That leads to people showing up to your offices in a number of cases across a number of different universities. And it makes the universities question whether or not doing that work is valuable. And they do begin to back away from it, unfortunately, in some cases.
Well, I know it's been reported that the Stanford Internet Observatory is being shut down. Is that a result of this dynamic, what you're talking about here?
I think that it's not being shut down. I think that they're now saying that they are kind of pivoting it. So some of us didn't have our contracts renewed and we are not there anymore. I think that the university has said that they're going to try to align it more closely with the research interests of its faculty director. So you'll see a little bit more work done on child safety, on teen mental health, that sort of thing. And so other aspects that it used to work on will no longer be part of its research agenda, but some facet of SIO will continue in that shifted capacity.
As you look forward and think about kind of how this dynamic will continue to play out, where do you see it headed?
So one of the things that's starting to happen is you're seeing people move into entirely new social platforms. You know, on the left, you're seeing people go to Threads, to Mastodon, to Blue Sky. It's unclear if that will stick. You had seen this on the right previously, you know, Truth Social, of course. For a while, there was Parler and Gab and Getter and a few on the right where they felt that the old Twitter's moderation policies weren't to their liking. So you see people moving into more distinct spaces, I think, which is an interesting shift. I don't know that it's necessarily a good shift. I go back and forth on this because you do want to feel like people can coexist in ideologically diverse spaces. Like, it would be very bad for us if that was not the case. So I think it kind of remains to be seen what's going to happen with that.
Really, really interesting points here, Renee. The book is called Invisible Rulers, and it is out now. Thank you for being here on Politico Tech.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for today's Politico Tech. Politico Tech is off next week, but I'll be back in your ears on Monday, July 8th. For now, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Our producer is Afra Abdullah. Our managing producer is Annie Reese. And our editors are Steve Heuser, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. Our music comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Be sure to follow Politico Tech on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen so you don't miss an episode. And if you're a regular listener, please recommend it to a friend or colleague who might enjoy it too. I'm Stephen Overley. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you back here on Monday, July 8th.